we're going this evening to Central America, so if it happens to be a little warm, it's nothing to what you'll find down there. In addition, they have something there which is very troublesome, called the garapoda. It is a minute tick which gets in under the skin and has to be taken out with the point of a penknife. Combined with the heat, several million of those really make an interesting time of it for all concerned. So perhaps you will forgive the present inconveniences as the lesser of several evils. This evening we have to deal with the Atlantis tradition in the Western Hemisphere. And it is an interesting subject that springs from a great many different roots and has a great many verifications and wanderings as we seek with different tribes for records. I've already mentioned the totemic records in the Northwest, the totem poles of the Canadian Indians, and how these frequently represent the deluge and the salvation of two human beings who were to become the progenitors of a new race. We find a similar record among the Atlantic Coast Indians around the Cumberland Gap area, also further south among the Seminoles. In fact, nearly all of your Atlantic seaboard tribes have legends of one kind or another relating to the existence of a land directly to the east of them. In the original Indian version, Great Rabbit, who later became confused with another man in Longfellow's poem of Hiawatha, Great Rabbit, leaving his people, took a canoe and returned to the mysterious land of the east, the land that was east to him, out into the Atlantic Ocean. The Seminoles have their account of the land bridge. The old Cherokee people also have interesting accounts of these ancient times. And with the rise of the Iroquois League extending up into Canada, we see evidence that may possibly tie to the old explorations of this region by the Norse people, the famous travels of Eric and many other hardy adventurers of those days. We are interested, however, also in the fact that these legends drift a long way from the Atlantic coast. In fact, we find them in the Middle West and particularly our Southwest. The reason for the connection with the Southwest may be, and we say this may be very definitely, the gradual moving northward of records from the Nahuatl people to the south. In other words, the Aztec influence upon our Southwest American Indian tribes. So we'll take one or two typical examples because we cannot possibly cover all of the various accounts. Some 30 years ago, I brought up here to Los Angeles one of the last of the great Navajo medicine priests, Hosteen Clark. He has since passed on, but he lived with me for several months and made a permanent record of certain of the early phases of his people's history, so far as he was able to restore this history. For he could only follow the traditional way of his people and say, this has been said, or it has been told, or this is the way our fathers knew it. There are no dates, there are no clear statements such as we might desire. But for centuries, the form of the sand paintings has been very carefully preserved. And it is notable even today that different sand painters, apparently with no direct contact with each other, when producing the same picture or the same symbolic purpose, produce work almost identical. There seems, therefore, to be a very strong traditional descent. And Carl Jung makes quite a point of this when he visited that area and studied these paintings in terms of his archetypal theories on a psychological level. Hosteen Clark was perhaps one of the last and most enlightened of his people. And the Museum of Ceremonial Navajo Arts in Santa Fe today was built very largely to preserve the relics of his work, to keep in the form of permanent recordings his sacred chants and many other parallel works of interest, because it was firmly believed then and known now that this knowledge is disappearing almost entirely from the younger men. The original form of the sand painting, as you know, is made of sand with various colored ground stones and pigments, and it is the law and the rule that at sundown the paintings must be destroyed. It is said in the ancient times that they were drawn up in clouds by the gods, and with sunset the drawings, the clouds, disappeared. Through the courtesy and kindness of Hastin Kla, however, he was willing to make, and did make, a whole series of permanent paintings, drawing them crudely in his own way with the simple materials of a child, but nevertheless preserving for us a truly authentic record of the designs involved in these paintings. I asked him at that time to tell me as much as he could about the beginnings of his people, and where, according to the legends of the general region, his nation came from. He said that he could only give us the legends. He had an interpretation of his own, but he did not know whether it was correct or not. He suspected that perhaps some of the progenitors of his tribes had lived somewhere below the rim of the Grand Canyon, that they had chosen to live far down in this difficult region because it gave them certain protection from their enemies, and they could place their little villages and communities in almost inaccessible localities. He believed perhaps that the legend that his people came out of the earth might have originated from some such a source, but the story is substantially this. At a time long ago, but before the sun and the moon came above the earth, the peoples, the Indians, his tribe — he knew no other Indians except those of the southwest — these peoples lived under the earth. The sun, the moon, and the stars were under the earth with them. They lived in a strange subterranean region, and instead of being lighted by the kind of lights that we know, it was lighted by four mountains. And these four mountains were at the four cardinal corners of the world. And these four mountains produced the seasons and the times of the day and all the changes that come in the natural course of a year. These mountains mysteriously rose and sank like suns, bringing with them various lights or changes of harvest and things of that nature. All his people lived there very happily, and everyone was well fed. There were no wars, there were no evils, there was no sickness. The peoples lived for a great length of time, and over these peoples there ruled seven elders, seven very good and wise chieftains, who were not just mortal men. They were kind of divine people, because they were built or created out of meteors and stardust. And their original home was the Milky Way. And they lived far removed from any ordinary mortal condition. These good gods and the people dwelt together in happiness until crime came. And this crime consisted of the stealing away of the infant child of one of the deities. And this child was stolen for selfish and bad purposes. Why, how, what? No one seems to know. But anyway, the child was stolen. And as a result of that, the wrath of the gods returned against this people. And a great flood of water was sent into the underworld. And the lower parts of it first were covered with water, and then the water rose higher and higher and higher, until it threatened to drown all the peoples, because they were in this vast cave-like region, and above their heads was a dark wall of earth. And in this critical time, they observed something that was of great wonder, namely that this water that was endangering their lives made the grain to grow. And various types of grain, particularly a maize or corn-like grain, grew very rapidly and to tremendous size, almost like the fabled beanstalk of Jack in the old fairy tale. So the human beings, seeking to escape the deluge that was gradually flooding their land, took refuge upon the branches of these grain stalks. And as the water rose, the grain stalks grew also, until finally the grain stalks reached the very under surface of the bowl of the earth above them, the surface of the earth. And here is Horstein Kla's drawing of the adventurous circumstances of his people coming up on the grain stalks. Now here on the branches of the grain stalks are all the little pre-Indians, the ones who were just coming out of the subterranean world. Now you will notice that some of the Indians are square-headed and some of them are round-headed. This refers to the fact that they are either male or female, the square heads being male, as might have been supposed. Now, with these creatures that climbed up on the grain stalks also came all kinds of animals and birds and everything else that had tried to escape from the underworld. Well, you can imagine that the traffic was rather heavy on the stalks, and space was at a premium, and it was not easy to get a reservation. So the story is that the wild turkey managed only to get on the lowest leaf of the stalk, and he was saved as a result, but his tail feathers dangled in the waters of the deluge, and the color was all washed out of them. Now, such legends as this, of course, are very common among all Indian peoples. But here you have what might almost be termed the Navajo story of the preservation of man from the deluge. The story continues to have a happy ending. For when these grain stalks reached the inner surface of the earth, they continued to grow, and they sort of bored their way through the earth's surface. And they came out into the upper world. And all along the way, we see these little peoples coming out of the earth where the holes were made for the grain stalks. And they came up with the grain. And they came out of the surface of the earth, and they found a strange world they'd never known before. A world in which there was, at that time, no life as we know it. But they also received another surprise, for the great mountains, the four great mountains that had lighted the underworld, came up also. And became the great mountains that surround the general area of the Navajo reservations. One of these, of course, Flagstaff Mountain, was very sacred and especially important to them. The Katsinas, or deities, mostly lived in those mountains and still live there today, according to the rituals and the religious doctrines of these people. When the little Indians from the underworld came up to the surface, the waters seemed to subside. Some waters came up too, and there were fountains out of the earth which made the land fertile. And the waters from the underworld made it possible for them to create gardens and land on the surface world. The mountains gave place to the birth of the sun and moon, and the deities went back into the sky again. And they built campfires out of petrified wood and lit them with lightning flashes. They had really quite a dramatic story. But behind all of this was Horstein Kla's simple belief that the beginning of his people was that they came from a land somewhere below which had been destroyed by water as a result of sin. These things put together give us a rather interesting story. Now, while Horstein was with me, I showed him a number of old books and manuscripts. And one of these books captured his fancy, and he looked at it many, many times, and he studied it very deeply. And of course, in our way of thinking, he was entirely illiterate. He spoke no English whatsoever. He neither read nor wrote, actually. The only thing he could make was his sand paintings, and he probably could have made certain pictographs which were common to his people, but he had no knowledge of languages as we know them. It was therefore only through the courtesy of a mutual friend, a young Indian by the name of Hoskin Oswood, that we were able to get a close contact with his thinking. But after looking over a number of manuscripts and old symbols, books, and things of that nature, Horstein Kla lighted up and said, and pointed with his very large brown finger, he pointed at the Chaldean, Babylonian, and Phoenician remains, and he said, "These our people knew about." I do not know what they knew. I do not know how they found out. But these different symbols and designs, according to him, he said, they touch something inside, deeper than memory. Something that goes back beyond my people. Now this is interesting, inasmuch as German research in the last 25 years has indicated that the typical American Indian cosmological belief is identical with that in the Valley of the Euphrates. That they are same general division of the universe. Although, of course, it's hard to say the American Indian any more than it is easy to say the Egyptian. Egyptian culture is divided into more than 50 major branches. The American Indians actually consisted of more than 150 nations, each with his own language, with his own beliefs, with his own concepts. So to say what all of them believe would be a very great exaggeration. But it has been noted that there is a broad prevalence among these tribes, and Schoolcraft also points it out, and he is the greatest authority on the American Indians, that there are infinite numbers of parallels between the beliefs of these people and the beliefs of the Assyrians, Chaldeans, and Babylonians. This goes so far as their division of the universe into the typical three parts, which we still find indicated in Christianity in the triple crown of the Pope, namely heaven, earth, and hell. The three worlds, the world that is above, the middle world in which mortals live, and a world underneath. This world underneath is where men came from and where they will ultimately return again. Everyone that is born out of some kind of a dark earth and returns to it again in the burial ceremonies, into the mounds or into the sacred remains. The earth is ruled over or governed from within itself by spirits. And one of these spirits, the most important perhaps, is the Great Earth Mother. And the Great Earth Mother, the Coatlicue of the Aztecs, was supposedly the one who was reached by the serpent messengers. And in the snake ceremonies, the serpents are released to carry the messages of the tribes to the gods that live under the earth. The serpents returning to their holes in the earth are supposed to convey the message. In the ceremonial temples of the Southwest Indians, there is usually a hole or well-like depression in one corner of the sanctum so that the voice or the words of the councils can go down to the Earth Mother and can be listened to by her great ear, which is represented by the bent in the ground. On the surface are the Indian peoples and nations scattered about. Above them, high in the air, is the abode of the gods, placed in a heaven region, as in the Near East and in ancient Asia. The messenger between the earth and the gods above is in among the North American Indians is the Thunderbird, the symbol of the priesthood, the bird that lives in clouds, the bird whose eyes flash to cause the lightning, and the flutter of whose wings brings thunder. And also it is this bird, when in flight and soaring with its wings fluttering, causes the rain to fall. All of these messengers from the earth, therefore, are birds flying upward, carrying the soul messages to the great spirits, the elders, the wise ones, the olds and the trues who live in the great medicine lodge above the sky. All this is essentially Chaldean and gives us something that perhaps is a clue to a contact between these people and other nations or other racial areas at a long, remote time. This is typical, what we've said is more or less typical of a wide variety of accounts relating to these matters to be found among the North American Indian peoples. Our records here are poor because of the lack of written form. Also because so much of the old legendary and lore has died out, many tribes have become extinct or completely submerged in the civilizations around them. For many years, it has been practically illegal for these peoples to celebrate or preserve their own rituals and rites. Therefore, by degrees, these things have disappeared, and the young men of today are not perpetuating them, as old Hosteen Claus so tearfully told me. Yet these people had a knowledge of some kind, legends and records going far, far back. As we go south, however, into more sophisticated regions, we find much more of interest in the form of records. Here, however, we are up against another difficulty. In the time of the Spanish conquest, there was absolutely no effort on the part of the conquerors to preserve or to investigate the contemporary cultures which they were rapidly destroying. We cannot say that this was true in all cases, but it was true in the majority of cases. We know that the conquistador Montejo, landing in on the peninsula of Yucatan, what is now Merida, not only massacred huge numbers of the natives, but ordered all their written records and books to be piled in the city squares and burned. Everything was done to destroy these records. Further north, the effort in the Aztec Empire was also rather thoroughly carried on by those who followed in the footsteps of Cortes. But, of course, in the northern area, we have a rather different situation prevailing, and it is necessary for us to pause for a moment and consider these situations and what they mean in terms of evidence relating to our principal theme. The Maya peoples had developed a highly specialized language. They had the skill to preserve and perpetuate practically any record of any kind which they desired or intended to perpetuate. That they were reasonably good historians and that they were careful in their thinking. We know from certain remnants that have survived from the transition period between the old Aztec and the old Inca and Maya period and that of the later Spanish. I'm referring particularly to the Chilamban, or the Book of the Old Men. The Chilamban of Cozumel, for example, which was in Merida and mysteriously disappeared after some American archaeologists passed through town. And what happened to it, we're not saying, but the book is gone. But it was a record of the origin of their people, as best as they could preserve it. But it was incomplete due to the difficulties imposed by the conquest. In the first place, it is probable from what we can learn today that the art of writing was held in the keeping of the priests, of the elders, of those who were custodians of great knowledge, the ordinary Indian peasant, commoner did not possess this knowledge so far as we can learn. Therefore, the disappearance of a priestly or governing class reduced the rest of the people to comparative illiteracy as far as the deciphering of written words and written languages would be concerned. Also, almost immediately, the Spanish introduced their own characters, and we have a polyglot situation arising that is quite remarkable and has continued to this day. The Mayas of Yucatan, Guatemala, Honduras, and other areas still speak their ancient language, but they write it in Spanish letters, they cannot read their glyphs, and they haven't the slightest way of associating the ancient monumental inscriptions with the words that they are daily using. They just do not know, and groups of them visit their ancient monuments with as much curiosity as any foreign tourist. They do not have the records, or if they have the records, as has been suspected, they are certainly keeping them to themselves. They are not telling anyone. The Archbishop Landa, who was in many ways a sincere churchman, a very intolerant ecclesiastic, but likewise scholarly, made an effort to discover or create the equivalent of a Rosetta Stone to bind the Spanish forms with the ancient Maya glyphs. He created an alphabet of 33 characters, having a certain sound equivalence and certain distinct meanings. And he has left this as what is known as the Landa alphabet. Now, the Landa alphabet is certainly composed of figures and symbols similar to those found in the ancient Mayan inscriptions. The only difficulty is you can't read the inscriptions with his alphabet. The final point appears to be this, that Landa took certain glyphs that were phonetically similar to the Spanish word or letter sounds. From these he formed a phonetic alphabet, probably following in part a rule which these Indians themselves used. Therefore, he could write in their glyphs sounds which they could pronounce and use these sounds as a means of teaching them Spanish. Very complicated situation, which perhaps gave great courage to the missionaries who are said to have been able by this means to introduce the Indians to the phonetic sounds of the Mass, but it did very little in terms of restoring the ancient writings and the ancient knowledge. Perhaps the most valiant person in this entire muddle, as far as records were concerned, was Father or the monk Fra Bernardino de Sahagun. This man was the first, probably, Americanist. He came over with the Spanish conquerors. He came over to give his life to the service of the poor benighted heathen Indians. But he had not been here long before he suddenly realized that a tremendous culture was falling apart around him. He used his influence and finally was able to convince some of his superiors of the importance of preserving an adequate record of the life and time, the beliefs, the philosophies, and the histories of these Indians. He gathered together all the native help that he could get. He traveled throughout the Mexican area. He secured copies or made copies of many of the most valuable pictographic manuscripts that have entirely disappeared. He worked heroically, and he finally compiled a great work which contained most of the available information. This great work exists in three or four early manuscript copies, the most complete of which is the great Florentine Sahagun, kept in the bibliothek in Florence. And this has recently been subject to a completely new translation by the Museum of New Mexico. It has come out in several volumes, restoring the astronomy, the medicine, the science of these ancient Indians. For Sahagun, then, we must have a word of great praise. But unfortunately, he was not concerned with Atlantis. He was, however, concerned with the origin of these people so far as he could trace it. And a study of his work is very valuable in helping us to orient some of these mysterious breaks in our tradition and legendary. The Aztec language, as a language, offers very few distinct difficulties. It is a language in a transition period, moving from pictographic into the syllabic form. It is a combination of pictographs and what might be termed true hieroglyphics, much as in the case of the Egyptian. These Indians, the Aztecs, had reached that platform in the development of their written form in which they had begun to compound words for various reasons and purposes, and to create hieroglyphical or pictographic representations of these compounds. They did this by the creation of composite creatures whose names had various meanings. Perhaps the simplest, most dramatic, and most familiar of all examples of this is the name Quetzalcoatl. This word simply means feathered snake, and the glyph for it is a snake with feathers. Yet any Aztec seeing this combination of the feather and the serpent would not necessarily think of the feathered serpent. He would think of the two words, Quetzal and Coatl, and therefore be in a position to pronounce the name that this represented. They had done this by the gradual developing of compounds. They would take the head of a deer and place it on the body, we will say, of some other animal, such as a dog. This was then to be pronounced as a new word combination, giving the possibility of naming places or naming persons, and the possibility of placing over the head of an individual the glyph which would be pronounced as his name, a glyph composed of two or three other objects grouped together in an arrangement which would indicate which part was pronounced first, then the center, and the final, or the beginning and end of the name. This shows the general degree which they had reached in the development of language. For the rest of the picture, their written forms are picture writing of a somewhat more sophisticated nature, however, than that of our North American Indians. The Mayas, on the other hand, had passed entirely beyond the picture writing stage. They had moved into the true pattern of glyphs, and they therefore reached the point in which they illustrated manuscripts. They used the glyphs for the text and put pictures in just as we do. One of the hopes that we have of ultimately solving their language is the relationship between the glyphic description and the picture representing it. We hope that this may ultimately prove to be the Rosetta Stone. Dr. Gates of Johns Hopkins has done the most, perhaps, in the effort to decode the Maya glyphs. He is the authority for the statement that in comparison to any other existing language, the nearest parallel he has been able to find to the Maya writing is the Chinese. He does not, however, say that it is his firm belief that this writing originated in China. But he is inclined to think that a psychology of some kind, the type of psychological approach which affected the Chinese mind in the development of its written form, also affected whatever was the attitude behind the gradual rise and development of the Maya language. We have today, through the work of many men, one of whom, perhaps Mr. Willard, is quite well known, who lived for some years, part of the time at Chichen Itza, and helped Thompson in the dredging of the sacred well. Willard and several others worked upon the glyphs, using the various dictionaries of the Maya language which are available, trying to bridge back and forth, between some word and the glyphic symbol of it, trying to pick out of the written forms the glyphs that would correspond with certain plants, certain animals, certain seasons of the year, working back and forth to try to create a means of writing in the glyph form or reading the ancient glyph structure. Through Spindon and Morley, we have been able to restore the Aztec numeration system and also the Maya. We know how they calculated time. We know the monumental and manuscript glyphs for the various great cycles. We also know their simple numerational system in which the dash or line represented 5 and the dot represented 1. Therefore, two lines, two horizontal lines with two dots under them, represented the number 12. This we also are able to restore from the tonalamatl or the calendar system. Actually, therefore, we have very little knowledge of the ancient languages. And the question is as to whether we have any true key to the Atlantic language, to the language of the Atlantean people. We have no true key. I've seen in the last 35 or 40 years probably 50 examples of alleged Atlantean writing. Some of this resulting from psychic revelation, some of it from old and undeciphered inscriptions in remote places, some speculative reconstructions based upon other languages, and a certain effort to arrive at what might be termed a mother language by combining all known forms. This, however, has had somewhat the reverse action of Esperanto. It has become a kind of polyglot, which gives us no official security in believing that we have actually found their language. If we wish to assume that perhaps either in Egypt or among the Central American peoples, we have a comparatively complete descent of the old writings, then it is possible that the Atlantean had a language somewhat similar or paralleling the Chinese or the Mayan or Egyptian glyphic forms. These were a highly specialized, highly flexible type of writing, not cramped as we would think by pictorial limitation, but susceptible by certain markings of being transformed at any point into phonetics, so that names, dates, and places could be inserted easily, and by certain rules, a symbol could either be a letter, a word, or an incident or circumstance which corresponded with it. The great trouble has been to differentiate between the various usages, because we have no knowledge of their grammar or essentially of their punctuational system or any way of dividing and arranging their forms. We know that the Maya, for instance, created a verb out of a noun by adding a wing, giving the sense of motion or vitality to it. We know that the Aztecs usually represented motion with footprints, moving, directions of things, or the flights of arrows, the flights of birds, or anything that signified motion. We know also, for example, that the Aztecs used the arrow to symbolize an enemy. They also used it to symbolize a course of action, a motion. They used it to symbolize conquest. And when an arrow was, or an atlatl, a javelin, was cast into the side of a symbol representing a mountain, it meant the capture of a city. All of these things tell us something, but they do not tell us too much. I have heard Mayan spoken, and it is a very beautiful and very musical language, a language which shows tremendous inflection and very subtle charm in all of the parts of it. The Mayan music is also a highly evolved and technical development within the structure of music. But we have very little information to aid us or direct us in our search for the origin of these people. And the great period of time which followed Fra Bernardino de Sahagún, very little was done until the 19th century, in which in the early part focus was drawn or attention was drawn to this area by the Abbé Brézeur de Bourbourg, a French archaeologist, who perhaps was one of the first to move into the field with a strange transcendental background that you would not particularly associate with his theological structure. But he was the one who perhaps first and foremostly pointed to the Maya people and the Central American civilization as Atlantean. He was, I think, perhaps the first to dare to make so strong a pronouncement. And his pronouncement was backed with considerable scientific research. He was heavily criticized, as might be expected, and he did work under great limitation for the reason that everyone has worked under a certain heavy, darkening cloud, the impossibility of restoring what the old Spaniards had destroyed, had left practically every thread broken, every connection shattered. And in addition to this, had created such intimidation among the people that they had almost locked their own souls against any remembrance of what they themselves knew. It was a tremendous complex, a tremendous neurosis descended upon these natives, and they became practically inarticulate. Following in the footsteps of de Bourbourg and tremendously influenced by his thinking, came the French scientist, photographer, archaeologist, Freemasonic scholar, and general mapmaker of parts, Professor or Dr. Augustus Le Plongeon. Le Plongeon has left two fairly important books dealing with the field. One is Queen Mu and the Egyptian Sphinx, and the other is Sacred Mysteries Among the Mayas and Quiches. Le Plongeon, great black beard, was a man of extraordinary personality and a strong devotee of the Atlantis concept. In fact, he tried in every way possible to popularize it. Le Plongeon has had the distinction of being the first man to go into the Central American area with a camera. Therefore, his photographs, made on the spot with wet plate negatives and developed at night in the dark temple recesses of the old buildings, are the first photographic records that we have, and they are very valuable because many of the ruins which he investigated probably 70 years ago, 75 years ago, are now no longer even in the state in which he found them. There's been progressive deterioration. Up in the valley of Mexico, for example, the pyramids of Xochicalco, this pyramid has been partly destroyed by the man owning the land on which it stood in order that he could build stables with the rocks. Everything has gone from bad to worse in that area and has seriously crippled all research. Le Plongeon was a dreamer, was an idealist. He went into the field in which nothing had been done. He made a great many mistakes, and these have been held against him, perhaps more than they should be, because he had no one to fall back on, no one to act as authority, no previous work upon which he could build. He went in with the machete and cut the jungle himself. That he should not have discovered things that were not found for 50 years later, we cannot blame him. But he did go in with two tremendous assets. One was a knowledge of the language. Laplongeon was one of the few Americanists who has ever known the Maya language. He could speak it and speak it well. He also went in with a tremendous basic sympathy for the people. He went in because he loved them, because he wanted to do something important with them and for them. He was quite a contagious person, apparently, in these respects, and the natives became so fascinated with him that they really made him a blood brother. He probably was able to get more out of the reticent Mayan than any other man before him or since. These points must be borne in mind in evaluating his findings. That certain of his archaeological conclusions may have been incorrect, we know. He claimed to have been able to read the Codex Troano, one of the great Maya sacred books. And he also claimed that this work contained a record of the Atlantean deluge. He also held that the Aztecs had a similar record, and that the Pyramid of Xochicalco, previously mentioned, had upon it a complete statement of these ancient records concerning the destruction of Atlantis, and was a monument created to commemorate the survivors of this catastrophe. Now, no one can prove or disprove Laplongeon. He claimed to have read the glyphs. I have seen his notebooks, in which day by day he and his wife pored over these inscriptions and carefully decoded them one by one. Because one of his principal keys in decoding was the Egyptian glyphs, because he had already observed and learned that hundreds of Mayan words are almost identical in pronunciation and in meaning with Egyptian words of the ancient dynastic period. He also, however, suspected and mentioned the possibility that this language had a tie with Asia. And he thinks a little also, like some of the other men, of the possibility of the Chinese being involved. As he preceded Gates, perhaps Gates is indebted to him for this phase of his own conclusions. Laplongeon remained a number of years in the area. He discovered a number of archaeological items of interest and importance. He had a bitter feud with the Mexican government and finally came home a broken-hearted man. He was never able to achieve his end, namely to open Central America to archaeology. But later, other men, following in his footsteps, achieved most of the end which he had attempted, but he did not live to see or know that this had occurred. Laplongeon, then, is a strong link with the Atlantis theory in the Western world. He derives much of his encouragement and thinking from the Abbé Brasseur de Bourbourg, followed very closely in much of his thinking, and attempted to reconstruct as much as he could from de Bourbourg's descriptions of certain important things, like the great Temple of the Cross at Palenque, which appears to have a very early Christian tie. I might also mention that about the year 1835, Lord Kingsborough, an English nobleman, became so tremendously impressed by the findings of the ancient codices and monuments and records, including the researches of Dupay, that he financed at his own expense a great work called The Antiquities of Mexico, which is bound variously in from 7 to 9 volumes of elephant folio. Tremendous books. These containing facsimiles of all known manuscripts and a faithful Spanish translation, but not into English, of the Sahagun, or the Dresden Codex of Fra Bernardino de Sahagun. Lord Kingsborough, himself quite a speculating thinker, who incidentally became hopelessly impoverished and bankrupt at the cost of the tremendous work he was doing, also believed that there was a distinct connection between the Maya Aztec complex and the Valley of the Euphrates. He comes in on this angle, and he believes that one of the apostles, perhaps Thomas, reached the Western Hemisphere as early as the first century. He gives a whole group of analogies, rituals, rites, and ceremonies tying the religious doctrines taught by Quetzalcoatl with the ancient teachings of the Babylonians and Chaldeans. Kingsborough also, in passing, tosses a thought towards Asia and also becomes a little wondering over the possible Chinese contribution. Kingsborough's works are of continual and pressing interest to us. They comprise today the largest available collection of the great Aztec Maya manuscripts to be found in the museums of Europe. The Aztec manuscript group, called codices, is not particularly limited. Probably 200 or 300 or more, perhaps, are known to exist. The Maya group is extremely rare, however, and up to the present time, only 3 works are known to exist. We have one here in our library, which we hope will prove to be the 4th original to exist. Dr. Morley, who was the greatest expert on the subject, passed very favorably on our manuscript. But these manuscripts are extremely rare. They make up the only surviving literature of a great people that had libraries and everything of that nature. There is always, however, in remembering the Dead Sea Scrolls episode, there is always the possibility that more will be found. It was on these codices that attention concerning Atlantis gradually came to be centered by the Bourbourg Le Plongeon and Lewis Spence of the British Museum. These men were all working on this particular theme, and they gave a considerable amount of literary space to it in the course of their lives. This also involved, to a degree, the thinkings of Ignatius Donnelly, who had already pointed in the direction of this Maya complex as a possible place for the solution of the Atlantic mystery. We told you before that there are certain remnants or relics relating to this subject that seem to have some importance for us. And I wanted to show you 2 of the highly controversial items because perhaps they will be of value. The homeland, or the place from which the Nahuatl people, the people of the Valley of Mexico, this would be in the Aztec area, trace their descent is a mysterious spot which they call Aziland, or Atziland. Now, in their language, this word does have certain suggestion of the term Atlantis, Aziland. They believe that they came from there, and here is one of the manuscripts, codices, in the Museum of Archaeology in Mexico City. This is the story of the wanderings of the Aztecs, that is, literal translation. A pre-Columbian pictograph work, translated from the original, which is in the Museum National of Mexico. This document, accurately colored to facilitate interpretation, and the edition limited to 25 numbered and signed examples. This is the official type of facsimile that is being issued by the Mexican peoples in order to facilitate the study of their ancient writings. Now, as it is said, this consists of what they call the wanderings of the peoples of the Valley of Mexico. No gate, naturally and obviously. Although the introduction of calendar elements might, under certain careful research and the comparison with the existing Tonalemodel, particularly the Aubin, might ultimately result in the possibility of dating it. I don't mean dating the manuscript. The manuscript itself is pre-Columbian, probably done 100, 200 years at most before the Spanish conquest. But dating the wanderings from the internal astronomical and calendar markings upon the manuscript. Now this is, I think, one of the most interesting because this is the beginning of the wanderings of the people of Mexico. From the codex or manuscript of the peregrinations or of the wanderings, you will observe here that at the beginning of their existence, we have to use their own method of writing. Here is a man in a boat who is to be the progenitor of the people. This is the beginning. You will find the footprints follow along all the way through the manuscript to the end, showing the wanderings of these people. Whenever they come to some place or something of that nature, where they stop or perform some action, we find the symbols of the place and of what they did. And in between are the periods of the calendar in which they remained in that location. This is the part which, from parallel with the Aubin, may possibly ultimately break the dating which they at least assigned to the original events. But here we have the beginning. We have a body of water. How large this body of water is, we will never know from the glyphs, because it is the same way with the Indian. A body of water may be a mill pond or an ocean. He has no way of differentiating between them. But he does tell us that his beginnings came from an island in that body of water, because here is a very interesting island located in the midst of a lake or some other area of water. Incidentally, on this island is a great temple and six smaller temples. In other words, he is telling us, for instance, in his own language, if he wished to read this as an Aztec, he could say this was the island of the seven houses or the seven places. Also, if you notice that on the top of this temple, which is created much like an altar, there are water symbols, symbols of springs or waters, or symbol of fertility, of goodness, of abundance, of the thing that the Indian always needed, and that was food, and things that were necessary to him. There is one large central building or altar with six smaller buildings around it. These are always building symbols, symbol of houses. Sometimes they put a man sitting on the front steps of his own house, and that is more or less home. That is his domicile. Unless he is a great man, then it is his palace. Below this symbolism is a representation of two human figures, one male and the other female. So here we have the Indian telling us that his progenitors, the father and mother, were on an island, the island of the seven houses or the seven temples, in the midst of a sea. Now by seven temples, you see, where you deal with pictographs, you have certain problems you have to face. You have to be a little more liberal than you would be with a more accurate form of language. Those house signs, as we say, are symbols of many things. In the native village in old times, only the temple or the palace was of permanent materials. The natives themselves lived in huts, which were easily destructible. Therefore, a stone building represents a capital. It represents a center of government, a palace, perhaps some important building. And by extension, it can represent the capital of a nation. Remember that Montezuma, who belonged to this culture group, and therefore should have quoted from it or should have understood it, in speaking to Cortez, said that he knew that his ancestors came from seven islands. Now these seven buildings could represent, therefore, empires, or anything of a basic septenary nature relating to leadership, government, origin, cities, races, clans, groups, culture groups. Now to get from where he was to his next destination, it was necessary for him, therefore, to cross water. Therefore he is rowing away from this land. He steps out upon the shore and he takes three steps. The footprints, however, do not necessarily indicate, as far as we know, any prescribed number of steps. It's simply that he traveled in that particular direction. This occurred at the time of one obsidian knife. Now, of course, that clears everything. We have a date. This occurred in the date of one flint knife, which incidentally was one of their day signs, or one of their astronomical symbols for the divisions of their month. Therefore, all this occurred in one, which is a beginning of something. It's the beginning of some calendar cycle. And it was in the beginning of the month or the day of the obsidian knife, which was later the sacrificial knife, and which also became later a deity, one of their most ancient gods being the obsidian knife, which was sometimes represented with human arms and had a very great importance for them. Now they went on a little time along the road here, and they came to a place. This is a place. Now this is not the kind of a place that one of these little houses is. This is a place in the sense that it is the area or land or tribal domain of a people, using a conventionalized form of the mountain symbol. This is an area. This is the land of somebody. We find in the Bible reference made to the traveler who came to the land of Canaan. This would be a land, a place, represented by a mountain. Now the name of this place we cannot completely restore, but we can give a certain amount of meaning to it. For this was the abode of the Eagle Man. This was the land of the Eagle Man. And if you remember in your Mexican history, the Eagle Man is still one of their most common symbols, a human face coming out of an eagle's mouth. This is represented here. Above this rises the sign of communication, of counsel, of discussion, and of certain treaties, pacifications, and various activities representing by these peculiar smoke signals or signs which rise out of this. And here we also find that they didn't stop, but they went on past this. And then we find the alignment of these peoples, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We find 8 peoples now, forming the next act in this drama. We find them with their symbols of their nations and tribes, represented by the glyphs by which their names can be read, and that each one of them spoke, for words come out of his mouth, symbols of breath and air. And then they start out, and 4 of them travel. And these 4 are represented by their names up above, telling who they are and what they are.